Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your social media feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Whitney Terrell, the author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
And I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, the author of the novel Brotherless Night.
Sugi, what's your paradise?
Excuse me?
I'm sorry. Does that sound dirty or something? What's the problem?
I don't know. Was it supposed to?
No, it was not supposed to. But you did react kind of strongly, like maybe you didn't appreciate the concept of paradise.
Okay, fair enough. But when you ask me what's my paradise, I'm definitely getting a very reality show Paradise Island vibe.
Okay, now hold on a second. We have got to be correct about reality shows. There's no Paradise Island reality show. That's a real place in the Bahamas. Maybe you're thinking of Temptation Island?
Not right now, I'm not.
Or maybe it was Bachelor in Paradise? Fantasy Island?
Bachelor in Paradise. Okay, maybe that's what I was thinking of. Fantasy Island is more your generation. But yes, the point here...
The plane!
Yes, the point here is that as all these franchises prove, and as all of human history proves, paradises don't really exist. And utopia is a pipe dream. And the people selling utopias are usually doing it for selfish reasons.
Agreed. Or at least I definitely agree that it can happen. The supposed utopia that Jim Jones established for his followers in Guyana did not turn out that good. But are you saying to me, oh great skeptic of the podcast, that utopia cannot exist? Are there no more paradises? Is there no part of human history that might be looked on as Edenic?
There is no way that I'm answering that question alone. But fortunately, we have a guest who can help us out with this topic, Paul Harding. Paul Harding is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Tinkers, as well as a follow-up, Enon. He's director of the MFA in Creative Writing and Literature at Stony Brook University and lives on Long Island, New York. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be back.
So your new novel is called This Other Eden. Sugi and I have just been arguing about the possibility of Edens or paradises, earthly type. Anyway, she says no. I say maybe. Could you talk about and describe the other Eden in your book? Where is it? When did you first begin learning about it or imagining it?
Sure. It was one of those strange kind of happy accidents, as it were. I was casting around for for another novel, you know, just trying to
as one
figure
does.
Something. Yeah, exactly. You know, and there's just a lot of that early, you know, just trying to invoke something. And I actually started writing about a minor character from my second book, Enon, an 80 or 90-year-old woman named Mrs. Hale, who has a big estate on, you know, in the town Enon. And I just thought, well, you know what I'll do is I want to go back and I'll write about her when she's like 10 years old. And I knew it wouldn't be the story, but I just, you know, had to have something to go on. So what I did was I just had this weird scene of like her and her mother and her aunts and stuff. And they're sort of having tea or a picnic in the big the meadow on the family's property. And as I do with all my novels, everything I'm reading, all the paintings, all the music I'm listening to, everything somehow or another get thrown into the manuscript at the earliest stages. As I was reading, I'm a sucker for still life and landscape painting, and I came across a 19th century American painter named Charles Ethan Porter, a black guy, and he has beautiful still lives and beautiful landscapes, and I came upon a wonderful painting of his of a meadow that had just been mowed, and they had just done the haying, and so I just literally threw into the background of the scene with Mrs. Hale as a child. Just there's some guy out there painting, you know, there's some guy out there with an easel and everybody's sort of wondering who he is, you know. And then at the time I was also reading, oddly enough, history of organized labor in the United States after the Civil War. And one of the things that's fascinating about unions is that they were one of the first institutions to advocate for civil rights, for women's suffrage, you know, that sort of thing. And it just occurred to me that there must have been all black towns or settlements or racially integrated settlements or communities throughout the country, you know, after the Civil War. So I just Googled, you know, a couple of key words, and I started finding, all, lo and behold, there are any number of these communities throughout, you know, throughout the country. And I eventually came upon the story of a place called Malaga Island, which is off the coast of Maine, southern coast of Maine, which from about 1792 or 1793 until 1912 was the site of a racially integrated community that was started by a black man who was had been formerly enslaved. They didn't know whether he escaped or whether he was freed, and his wife, who was a woman from Galway, Ireland. And so I was intrigued, and I was, you know, having written about Maine before in my book Tinkers, I thought, oh, that's interesting, Maine. And then it turns out that I discovered that some of the people, so the people were evicted by the state of Maine in 1912, the summer of 1912. And in reading about it, I discovered that a number of those people were committed to a place called the Maine School for the Feeble-Minded. And that was one of the institutions also that in my earlier book, Tinkers, a character was going to be committed to a place that was similar to that. So I thought, oh, you know, because as a novelist, you'll say, you know, give me a sign, give me a sign. And then the thing that sealed the deal for me was in my reading, reading about eugenics and about all this sort of stuff, you know, just that sort of came up with the couple of articles I read about the island. I discovered that almost to the month, I think, the people were being evicted from the island, the first International Congress for Eugenics was taking place in London. And I just felt like, that's it. That's the sign. You know, the dowsing rod started to twitch. And so I just started to, I realized when I went back to my little, the germ of the novel, it was just one of those funny moments. I just looked, and, you know, somebody mentioned, you know, in what I'd been writing, who's that guy out in the field painting? And I realized that person somehow or another was from Malaga Island. And then the mystery was, I've got to figure out how he came to be in Enon, Massachusetts, painting.
That's an amazing story. I was sort of imagining that you had, and I was like, how is Paul going to answer this question? Did he happen to end up on Malaga Island? And, you know, you referenced the formerly enslaved man and his wife from Galway. And in the novel, this is Benjamin. These people appear as Benjamin Honey and his wife Patience.
Right.
They arrive in 1793. And those are basically the first lines of the novel. And I wonder if we could just go over the inhabitants of the fiction. In the novel, this is fictional Apple Island. And I wonder if we could just go over who is there real quick, because the now of the story is 1911, and who's still there from the Honey family? What other families live there, and who are Esther and Ethan Honey?
So Esther is she's certainly one of if not the main characters in the book. The book sort of moves protagonists around a little bit, but she's probably a great grandchild of Benjamin and Patience, the original couple. And she's kind of the matriarch. She has a son named Eha, and he has three children. And has two daughters and a son named the son's name is Ethan. And one of the things that was striking about the articles that I read about Malaga Island were the photographs. There were photographs from the island and of the folks who lived there. And one of the most striking photographs was there's a school on the island, and there was a picture of all the kids that were at the school. And the children ranged in skin tone from, you know, from the people who presented as absolutely white to people who, you know, had more, were absolutely black, you know, just darker skin. I thought that was fascinating. And I had been, was thinking of James Weldon Johnson's autobiography of an ex-colored man, and that. So then, you know, just as you kind of, again, are riffing and kind of experimenting with the parameters and what you have on your hands, I just thought, you know, if Ethan is this painter, maybe he presents as white. And so there's that family. And then there are a couple of other family, you know, the sort of the remnants, you know, these sort of a few stray people from a formerly more robust community. So there are a couple of sisters who live together in like the cabin of an old schooner. And there's a family of people who are quite inbred, and they're sort of otherworldly. The children all kind of only come out at night. They're the people that in the book end up being sent to this school for the feeble-minded. And then there's a guy named Zachary Hand to God Proverbs, who's a Civil War veteran. He fought in the Connecticut, one of the black regiments from Connecticut in the Civil War, and he lives in a tree, and he makes carvings of scenes from the Old Testament. So there's this, you know, it's the I think in reality there are like 47 people on the island, but I just scaled it down to concentrate on a smaller cast of characters. And then there's this white school teacher slash sort of missionary named Matthew Diamond, who has come to the island with the best of intentions. And he's actually a very good teacher, and he teaches the students and a number of Ethan Honey is very good at painting, but there's a girl who's really good at Latin, and another girl is, you know, great at algebra. But since Ethan presents as white, one of the things that Matthew Diamond decides to try to do is to quote unquote save Ethan by having a wealthy friend of his sort of sponsor Ethan. And that ends up being the character who owns the estate in Enon.
I want to talk about Diamond, because he's, you know, he's a representative of mainlanders, right? As the people on the island call him. And, you know, you include a letter early on in the book where he writes to a friend where he says, "I feel repulsion in the presence of a living Negro," which is not the best start for him as a character. And he seems, while he seems to have like pity and concern for the islanders, he also seems unable to let go of the racial categories that he's been brought up with. Is that correct? I mean, how would you talk about, you know, his sort of liminal role there in between the state and the people that he loves but doesn't know how to categorize?
Yeah, you know, so partly it's just a case of, you know, the best intentions being, you know, producing terrible, the worst possible results. Yeah. And I wanted to make him, you know, on the one hand, you know, a mixture of better and worse impulses, you know, this is one of the things I love doing as a writer is putting things that are opposite right next to each other and never telling the reader what to think, you know? So on the one hand, he says that terrible thing and he has this prejudice, but he's also the only person who's actually trying to help the islanders. And so I just wanted to make it sort of irreducible that you can't, like, I didn't want to invite a thumbs up or thumbs down judgment of him. I want him to be kind of irreducible and complicated that way. The other thing taking many pages from Shakespeare, but one of the things that I'm always fascinated with in Shakespeare's plays is that for the most part, all the characters who misbehave know they're misbehaving. They know better, but yet they do not, so I liked the idea of him being aware that this was a terrible aspect of his character that he laments and yet still experiences. And I actually got the idea from that in my spare time as a citizen. I'm kind of a theology nerd, and I've read many, many thousands of pages of this Swiss theologian named Karl Barth. Just wonderful kind of cosmology and metaphysics and literary, you know, kind of exegesis. I really, really love it. And he was one of the founding members of what was called the Confessing Church, which during World War II was one of the few institutions that openly disobeyed Hitler and worked and helped to get Jews out of Germany. And, you know, so his creds were good with me, you know, really. And after 20 years of reading him, I just happened to come across a book of correspondence of his where in a letter he's talking about how happy he is that his son does not suffer the affliction that Karl Barth does, which is the visceral disgust. His words were the visceral disgust that he feels when he's in the, he felt when he was in the presence of a living Jew. And, you know, that was just like, you know, so as a novelist, I'm like, that's pure gold. I'm gonna give that the version of that line to this character. And, you know,
so that line is a deep cut in your reading there.
It's a deep cut. Yeah. So that's but that again, that's to me, that's pure gold in terms of character and dramatic tension. And because you can't, I don't think there's an easy answer, you know, for that. And that's one of the things going back to Esther, you know, Esther, the second he walks onto the island and she sees him, she knows like disaster is imminent, yeah. You know, that he's going to bring ruin to their community.
So when you're writing a character like that, how does it feel to you?
Well, I think as a writer, you have to be able to write, you know, it'd be like, you know, how did it feel to write Macbeth, you know, like, actually Macbeth would have been kind of fun, you know, so, you know, I don't know. It feels serious. You know, you have to write, you have to be very careful. But I wanted it to be real. You know, I wanted there to be a kind of realism. I didn't want to write, I didn't want to make him a villain. You know, I didn't want to make him into just like a one-dimensional sort of like, and he's the bad guy. I wanted him to be a real character that people would have to actually kind of think about and be laid claim to. And that's also why I gave him the awareness and the fact that he really understands that that's a terrible aspect of his own character. So that just seems that, you know, that the perennial human predicament of knowing better but not acting, you know, like right. From all the way from like, I know I shouldn't smoke cigarettes and here I shouldn't eat that cake. I shouldn't leave my brother in the ditch.
I shouldn't be a giant asshole.
Well, you have to advocate for your characters, even if they're doing the wrong thing. I feel like you as a writer, when you're in their head, you're trying to marshal your forces to make as convincing an argument as you can to the reader for their humanity, despite the bad things that they're doing. It's kind of like a trick.
Yeah, and it's for me, it's less explanatory than it is just descriptive. What is it like for him? Yeah. What is it like for him to have this feeling and feel conflicted? And yet he's there, he's educating them, you know. I wanted it to have some of the kind of complexity and ambivalence and ambiguity of like real life when people actually, you know, sort of with and worse feelings towards one another, try to negotiate one another's humanity.
Yeah, I think I'm just curious about this because you sort of mentioned, of course, that you want this to be, I don't know, maybe productively uncomfortable for the reader, or maybe that's how I would think about it. And so I have been sort of thinking about what
for Sugi, that's a kind of paradise, being productively uncomfortable.
Productively,
that's how her everyone in her utopia would be productively uncomfortable all the time.
All of the squirming.
Squirming. I don't want the reader to squirm. I don't like making readers feel uncomfortable. My hope is, and it's, you know, the way that I treat it too, which is like, you know, this whole story laid claim to me because I was like, this is a quintessential, you know, it's a Maine story. It's a New England story. It's a United States story. It's a human story. You know, that's why I have all the stuff about, you know, Genesis and Eden and Exodus and all, you know, Old Testament, because it's just this displacement, you know, these sort of communities that just get, you know, just kind of just, you know, sort of swept off. And so I wanted to be realistic, and I just wanted to, you know, respect the reader and give them something where they when they look at that character, their participation with that person, that character is, resembles what it's like to encounter people like that in real life.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back. So speaking of real historical figures, Darwin plays a role here, or at least Darwin's theories as they were perverted by later generations, including his own son, into the very non-scientific pseudo field of eugenics. Could you talk to us about how those theories threaten this community on Apple Island and then read to us from the book?
Yeah, sure. Well, the community sort of considers the larger community on the mainland considers the settlement to be kind of a blight, you know, on their image and just on their community. And so they, I have it so that they, which is, echoes what really happened, you know, these ideas of blood and blood being pure or polluted. And, you know, you get these old, like you say, pseudoscientific, but they were, I mean, race itself, we should remember, once was a science, you know, it was ideology masking as, you know, trying to pass under the imprimatur of objective empirical science. And so one of the things that happens to the island is that a group of doctors and people come over and they kind of do the craniometry and all those dreadful kind of, you know, thinking of like Stephen Jay Gould and The Mismeasure of Man. He had that book about Lombroso and all this kind of phrenology and stuff like that. And that's, you know, those are two of the poles that I, you know, the as it were, you know, white characters always, you know, when they talk about that kind of thing, it's the idea of purity, pure white, right, as opposed to, you know, polluted or corrupted blood. And the way that the islanders talk about it, you know, the worst thing that you can be is plain white, you know. So the idea that, you know, this whiteness and the way that it's negotiated, and the worst thing is to be plain white, you know. And anyways, so yeah, so what happens is, yes, this council comes and sort of subjects all the people on the island to these just violent, you know, there's no other word for it, it's just violent, humiliating types of, inspections and measurements and all
well,
this
let's
sort
hear
of
it.
Stuff.
Read that part.
Yeah, sure. So this is when the committee has arrived. The committee began with Iris and Violet Proverbs and the Sockalexis children. Iris and Violet take care of three Penobscot children who are orphans. Violet was in the yard, stirring a load of overalls and dresses in the scalding pot. Iris and Emily Sockalexis stood back to back in the open scuttle of the pilot house, Iris scouring a dress over a washboard at one wash tub, Emily pummeling a pair of denim pants through the cold rinse water in the other. Scotty and Norma Sockalexis struggled to spread a wet bedsheet over the split rail fence for drying. Violet saw the group first and called out to her sister. Iris shouted out to them, who were they, still scrubbing her the dress. We're from the governor's office and doctors. Doctors, huh? Iris stopped her washing and studied the group. I didn't know doctors traveled in gangs. She wiped her hands on her apron and told Emily to finish rinsing the pants, then finish with the dress. She climbed down into the pilot house and came out the front door. We need to see the other girl too. And them, one of the men said, nodding toward Norma and Scotty, who stood holding either end of the sopping sheet, staring at the intruders. The other men began looking around the yard, noting the layout, the amniotic stink of the boiling soap, the messy hopper bin full of white ash where the sisters drew the lye, the patched and worn clothes the children wore. Iris grabbed the laundry stick from Violet and brandished it at the men. You're not anyone we know, she said. Stay away from here. And you, get. This is an official matter of the state, one of the counselors said. State my eye. Now, Iris, please, Matthew Diamond said. I don't like this any more than you do, but they are here on the state's authority, and there's nothing we can do to change that right now. One of the doctors had brought a pair of metal calipers from his medical kit, and without having asked, was fitting them on either side of Scotty's head, even as the boy still held one end of the wet sheet. Violet dashed over and batted the bizarre tool out of the doctor's hands. Scotty dropped the sheet, and tears spilled from his eyes. Get that damned ice picker away from his head. Violet gathered Scotty close and cradled his head against her bosom. The doctor stooped and picked the calipers up and wiped them clean with the forearm of his coat. It's not an ice It's a scientific instrument. It won't hurt. This is necessary, ma'am. Please, just necessary my teeth, Violet said. Go near him with that thing again and I'll... She fainted at the doctor as if to punch him. Matthew Diamond said, Violet, no. Just stop and I'll help sort this out. I can write to the... Mr. Diamond, Violet said without taking her eyes off the alarmed doctor. You're a good man as far as it goes, but your letters ain't worth balls on a U. Pardon me, and I'm going to write a busted jaw on this cute Flatlander's face. And she fainted another lunge at the doctor.
Thank you. I think, you know, I for one am cheering for Violet when she lunges. You know, I mean, who's not like, give him hell, Violet.
I was like, oh, give her a good...
You know, she says necessary in my teeth and we're all aboard. And they're measuring head sizes because they believe that skull shape and the bumps on a skull are an indication of character. And, you know, you were talking before about phrenology and mental abilities. Yeah. And phrenology is, of course, a totally bogus science. And so I'm curious, here's a softball. Did any contemporary pseudoscientific theories influence your investigation into the pseudosciences of the past?
Not so much contemporary. I mean, there is all the QAnon in the air and, you know,
Ivermectin came to mind when I was reading this scene. I was thinking about all the pseudoscience that had come along for ideological reasons to accompany the COVID outbreak.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think that that's the thing, you know, the thing I find myself interested in is... again, what people attach the label science to, you know, and how, you know, we have this sort of, I believe in science, you know, it's anybody's yard, you know, yard signs. And it's sort of like, science is not a metaphysical phenomenon, you know, there are gestures or acts which are scientific. And so the idea of kind of this... really just very, very crass kind of three-card Monty that people play with dressing up just what is old-fashioned racism and bigotry and hatred as if they are, you know, authentic, inevitable truths about humans. And I think that that's something that for all the scientific progress there is, there is still, like, you will always have people attempting to do that. So that's what I'm always, you know, that I'm sort of fascinated by. And yeah, and I think the COVID, all that sort of the anti-vaxxers and that sort of stuff, that was fascinating to me too, because, you know, for example, when you'd hear the black community does, you know, this swaths of the black community that don't trust vaccine, you just think of, you know,
But that comes from scenes like the one you read, where you had a long history of a population that's been treated poorly by the medical community, very different from the people at, where was that big biker rally that was like in the middle of COVID?
Sturgis?
Sturgis. Very different than the people at Sturgis who don't have a...
That was right near
me. Yeah. And I mean, those things are... I don't, you know, they're just fascinating, because when you look into the history of science too, science is very, you know, like facial recognition. Right. Or artificial intelligence, you know, the algorithms, if the algorithms are written by white, you know, algorithm writers or whatever, they skew. And it's as if like, oh, no, this is just value neutral. And so much of science and technology are white, as it were. You know, they are like the scientific revolution, you know, that says who, you know. And so I think that's
we just talked about that, those algorithms, in our last episode, actually.
Is that right?
That's a nice connection.
Yeah, it's in the air, but I think that's what's so, there's something perennial about those things and the human misadventure. One of the things I read was, you know, there's this famous speech called the Cornerstone speech that the vice president of the Confederacy gave. I can't remember his name, you know, is a spontaneous justification for slavery. His entire argument is based on its scientific fact that the black race is inferior to the white race. And you can't, it's science. It's just, you know, you can't deny that. And that all of the, abolitionists were a bunch of religious fanatics. You know, so it's just astonishing.
And as you might expect, after this result from the visit from these scientists that you read about to us, we get an article in the Foxton Journal, which is the newspaper in the nearest mainland town, whose headline reads, "Queer Squatters Deemed Degenerate." And one of the things that I noticed in the book was that the word queer appears frequently in reference to the Apple Islanders in a context that's totally different, but not totally unrelated to the way that we use the word today. And I assume that wasn't accidental. And I wondered if you could talk about that, the way you're using that word in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, the word itself was prompted by a, I think maybe like an inset photo of an actual article from one of the local newspapers. Queer South Sea Islanders, you know, something like, you know, that just a strange, you know. And it made me think about, you know, queerness and queer, words like queer, but also words like, you know, these people are marginalized, right? And there's the mainland, but it's sort of like, you know, when I was sitting and thinking of myself as Esther, you know, on the island, they're like, you're in my margins, you know, so, we're the mainland, you are, you know. So just this idea of otherness and being marginalized and just like who's margin, you know, one person's margins or another person's life. And so to be queered off of what is norm, you know, the norm. And the more, you know, think about it, the more you think, if that's the norm, I don't want to be any part of it, you know, and you start thinking about just what queerness is. And in that case, too, I remembered talking with somebody in Provincetown, a friend of mine, musician Greg Kendall, was doing a bunch of interviews in Provincetown about art and about the community and this sort of thing. And I just remembered, I don't even remember the whole context, but he said he was talking to an artist, and the artist said, "Well, you know, artists are queers for beauty. You know, they're queer for beauty. So if you're queer for something, you know that." And then kind of the main passage in the book, you know, that sort of takes queerness and sort of, you know, permutates with it. I gave to this character, Zachary Handegod, and I just gave him a monologue that I just tried to make like a Whitman poem, you know, kind of like.
He's a very powerful character. I like him. I mean, he's probably one of my favorite Islanders.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with any of these books is, you know, you just end up loving these people, you know? Like, I didn't want to finish the book. I'm like, I don't want to leave. I don't want to leave. But yeah, and he's sort of a, you know, the book has a lot about prophecy in it too. You know, the idea that, which is, you know, I got from teaching the Old Testament and just gave it to Esther but the idea that prophecy, a prophet is not somebody who can like magically tell the future. A prophet is somebody who looks at the present and sees it clearly and calls it like he sees it and speaks truth to power, you know, and can kind of cut through all the ideological baloney and all that sort of stuff. So it's not that you can see the future, it's that you see where it's at. You know where it's at and you say where it's at. And if you know where it's at, the future is not difficult to predict, you know? And so, yeah, Zachary, this kind of poem or this ode or this lyric about queerness I just wanted to give him just this very powerful, poetic kind of almost sounding like it's, you know, biblical grade poetry, and just turning that word around.
To say that it's Whitmanian makes a lot of sense to me. And it's also interesting sort of how continually throughout your answers, there's a lot of connection to Ekphrasis and then also to the other work, like this sort of whole world that you're building. But speaking of the future and seeing the future, the state of Maine, the great state of Maine, issued an apology about what happened on Malaga Island in 2010 and kind of like failed to tell most of the people who might have cared about it. So I'm curious about whether you talked to descendants of people who lived on Malaga Island and maybe what you thought about incorporating, because the epigraph of the novel has a snippet of the state of Maine conveying its conveying its regret and, mm-hmm. and just wondering how you thought about that, the future of that island when you were writing about his past.
Yeah, it's interesting because I didn't want to write an historical novel per se. You know, I came across that's the story of Malaga Island. It laid claim to my imagination. It laid claim to, you know, it's America, American history, you know, race in America, all this sort of stuff. So it was just so compelling. But I also knew that I wouldn't be the person to write like a nonfiction book about Malaga. I wouldn't be the, and I didn't want to write a novelized or fictionalized version of the actual people that lived there. So, you know, the sort of the facts that I only read 2 or 3 articles about Malaga and then deliberately stopped. In the book, actually, the Maine is never mentioned, you know. I'm not trying to be coy or anything, but I also was like, I'm not trying to take it out on Maine. This could have taken place in any state in the Union, you know. But one of the things that I tried really hard to do, and I feel like people are getting it, you know, is that when there are sections of the book that are fictional texts from texts about an exhibit that was done 100 years after the islanders were evicted, talking about how you know, it's important for us to think about this, and it's important for us to look at this terrible episode in our history, so that it could never happen again. And I don't know, I like the hair on the back of my neck always stands up whenever I hear the phrase, "We have to make sure this never can happen again," because usually somebody saying that is not aware of the fact that it hasn't stopped happening, you know, that it's just ongoing, and that like it's just, you know, so every time it happens, you're shocked and you go, "Well, this can't happen again," and it's, you know. And so I wanted the prose in that section to make people sort of uncomfortable, and it sounds authoritative, and it's kind of I don't know, it's sort of casual and disrespectful, and it's almost kind of like the idea that the people that wrote that. And again, not in real life, the way I wanted to use it imaginatively, but the people wrote that, I want there to be kind of an unsettling sense that, wow, those sound like they could have been the people that were kicking them off the island 100 years ago in the name of their own righteousness, you know. I hoped that would be something that would be apparent.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we're going to encourage our listeners to go pick up This Other Eden, which is out now.
Great. Thanks so much. It's always a blast talking with you.
Thanks so much for being here, Paul.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Anne Kniggendorf. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done it yet. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll also post that show page with links to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can find video of our interviews at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and IGTV channel, and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where our back episodes are grouped by topic areas. Happy reading!